I love the sound of breaking glass. J'espère que vous êtes bien à notre écoute. Notre lunchtime en anglais continue avec la chronique Breaking Glass de Dennis Bro. I need the noises of destruction.
Cannes 2018 versus Cannes 1968. What a falling off is this? This is Bro on the World Film Beat, Breaking Glass at Cannes 2018. I would like to begin this Cannes competition wrap-up with the opening of At War, a film about the immolation of the French working class, an apt quote for these media-induced apathetic times. And this is the quote from Bertolt Brecht. It's possible to struggle and lose, but if you don't struggle, you've already lost. Now to the hyperspectacle. The dust has settled, the prizes are bestowed, and Cannes 2018 is in the books. The American trade paper subjected the festival to consistent attacks, with The Hollywood Reporter suggesting as one of its five reasons why Cannes is no longer so relevant that there are not as many billboards for American blockbusters. The festival is having problems, but lack of billboards championing masterpieces like Cars 12 and Fast and Furious 27 are not among them. Hollywood has somewhat boycotted the festival, perhaps figuring Venice works better for highlighting the Academy Award fair. On their side, the French theater owners also closed ranks, threatening to fire the Cannes director Thierry Frémaux if he again allowed Netflix films, which do not open in French theaters, in the main competition. Frémaux, whose natural disposition is more ecumenical, then returned the festival to art house competition only, but without Amazon and Netflix, two of the main American producers currently of independent fare. The open war that broke out at Cannes really is the expression of a competition between Hollywood / Netflix and the rest of the world. Foreign profits are now more crucial to the Hollywood Netflix bottom line, and when the studios and the streaming services took their toys and went home, they wanted to make it seem like the sandbox would then collapse, though both were highly active in snatching up films in the Cannes market. That aside, though, many of the films this year were problematic. They often began well, but succumbed to various faults. The Godard film was a milestone, but the Lars von Trier and Zhou Zhenku films were both lacking. Two Italian films, Happy as Lazaro and Dogman, have wonderful first halves, then seem to succumb to the same malaise that is afflicting the country as a whole, which saw this week the first far-right party come to power in a Western democracy. Black Klansman, which did win the second prize at the festival, is the best and worst of Spike Lee, and Under the Silver Lake begins in Hitchcock-David Lynch ecstasy in its perceptive presentation of capitalism's compulsion to erase mystery and wonder from the world, but then itself substitutes lazy Hollywood pseudo-philosophizing for critique. Nevertheless, there were films to like, with my top five in and out of the main competition being Yom Hadin, an Egyptian road movie that's a tour through a brutal neoliberalized Egypt, Cold War, an unexpected complex examination of both sides of that conflict, the image book, Godard's masterful indictment of and paean to European civilization and its troubled relationship with the Arab world, The Spy Gone North, which begins as a Cold War missive itself, then morphs into a revealing look at the powers on the peninsula wanting to maintain the war, and At War, Stéphane Brisé's penetrating examination of what may be the last stand for French workers losing their place in the global economy. There were films also not to like. Two of these were Solo, a Star Wars story, where we find out how Han Solo met Chewbacca, and a whole lot of other things we didn't need or want to know, in Disney's attempt to push the franchise well beyond oversaturation. And On the Road in France, a cross-country trip by May 68's Daniel Cohn-Bendit, who unfortunately is now a Macron backer, and whose grilling of the workers he encounters about how they could be more productive and relevant is a very Macronese take on the French working class, which now must justify its very existence. First the best. Yom Hadin is better and more trenchant than most critics here thought. An aging leper in rural Egypt, whose wife has just died, goes on a quest with a boy he has adopted to find his long-lost parents who had dropped him at a colony. What he finds, though, is an Egypt full of corruption, competition, and greed, as the police shackle him, fellow travelers steal from him, and his family at first shuns him. In short, a trip through the American-backed al-Sisi dictatorship, which betrayed the Arab Spring. Hope, though, comes from social outsiders and outcasts, including the Muslim Brotherhood member who escapes from jail with him, three cripples, one a former truck driver run over by a drunken scion of a wealthy family who reinstill his confidence, and the boy Obama, who will not forsake him. A chilling scene is his watching a cruise ship at night in his first gazing at the Nile from his perch next to his beat-up mule-drawn wagon, with the Egyptian elite streaming by and partying in the face of and oblivious to his misery. Godard believes in the power of images and in their constant juxtaposition, and the image book, somewhat akin to Elegy of Love, Film Socialisme, and his 3D Goodbye to Language, simply overwhelms with his quoting and mixing of films from Johnny Guitar to Vertigo and Art Delacroix, for example. That is, works of creation of Western civilization with footage of napalming and massacres in Vietnam, atomic explosions, and devastations of the Arab world. The overall impact, though, in this case is not the celebration of the images, as in his histories of the cinema, but the sense of the image culture Godard loves, hates, being complicit with the destruction and devastation that the West has unleashed on the rest of the world. The festival's masterpiece besides the Godard is Polish director Paweł Polanowski's Cold War, an instant Oscar contender for best foreign film, if not best film period. The film, which covers a decade in frayed European relationships because of the Cold War, is shot in resplendent black and white, which catches, yes, the drabness of the Eastern Bloc, but also in more high contrast, the glitter that is not gold of the West, and particularly Paris. The film explores the way the aspirations of artists, here star-crossed lovers, a singer and a composer accompanist, were similar in the Second World to the First World, with the performers from the Polish countryside wanting to get to Moscow instead of New York and London, and with divided Berlin as their meeting point. The Cold War of the title also refers to men and women, but that conflict between the two leads takes second fiddle by the end, to the way that they can find no peace on either side of the socialist-capitalist curtain, and are eventually consumed by this war among peoples who are more alike than different. The presentation of Stéphane Brisé's At War received a 15-minute ovation at the end. The film details the way French workers at a factory who were promised to work for 5 years and who gave up back hours and wages now find the German-owned company, which is making a profit, going back on its word and closing because, as is revealed later, it can reduce wages even further by moving to Romania. The film premiered the day after Oxfam announced that of the leading industrialized countries, French businesses returned the greatest share of their profits, 68%, to shareholders who simply pocketed the money, a factor which is revealed in the film as driving the closing. The film concentrates solidly on the attempts to resist the firing of the factory workers, with little psychologizing of its characters, which sort of keep it centered. The only problem was the overemphasis on one worker, played by Vincent Landon, one of the only professional actors in the cast, but a miscue in a film whose subject was the collective group of workers. This character, though, comes to express the near hopelessness of these workers caught in the global corporate vise, and the ovation of the premiere at the premiere seemed to be as much for French workers themselves as for the cast, crew, and film. The Spy Gone North, not an action film, but a taut espionage and suspense thriller, begins in promoting the Cold War itself as a South Korean spy, dressed up as an entrepreneur, attempts to ferret out in the 1990s whether the North is constructing atomic weapons. Strangely, that task is forgotten in the film's much stronger second half, as it details the way that military men on both sides want the buildup to continue. And in the South, the way the intelligence service was used to attempt to sabotage the election of a peace candidate. The film's feel-good ending affirms a friendship between the spy from the South and his corresponding contact in the North, validating the will of the people to have peace. Now to the problem films. Blaxploitation, like its bombastic title, is a narrative that too often stays at the level of style in the story of a black police officer in Colorado in the 1980s who helped infiltrate the Ku Klux Klan. The presentation of Stokely Carmichael and the black liberation rebels is superficial sloganeering, and the celebration of police informants, here both black and white, hews too closely to the current Democratic Party strategy of celebrating the FBI's investigation of Trump. Be careful what you wish for and who you are celebrating. The strengths here are Spike's mixing of materials and use of documentary, including the, as always, magnetic presence of Harry Belafonte, telling a story of a 1916 lynching intercut with the Klans watching the film Birth of a Nation, Alec Baldwin's impersonation of a grand Klan wizard in the opening using Trump phraseology, and the closing montage, which highlights the resurgence of right-wing street violence at Charlottesville, and a transcendent dance scene in a black club to the Cornelius Brothers and Sister Rose's It's Too Late to Turn Back Now. Zhejiangke's ash is pure as white has another miraculous performance by his muse Zhao Tao in a film about three phases of contemporary China's transformation into a freewheeling and profitable but less communal economy and society. Her performance recalls first her role as ingenue gangster's Mal in Unknown Pleasures at the moment of the country's initial capitalization, as wronged wife in Still Life in its critique of vast expansion, such as the Three Gorges Project, which shows up here as a place where she is swindled by an entrepreneur, as female action figure from A Touch of Sin, as here she saves her gangster boyfriend and takes the rap for him, and finally as gambling parlor elder, which recalls her struggles to triumph over a hard life in Mountains May Depart. The problem is we have seen it all before, and though this adds to Zhao's luster as perhaps the greatest actress in the modern cinema, it does not add so much to Zhu's work or deepen his concerns. Two films which initially appeared promising but then end up vacant are Lars von Trier's House That Jack Built and the actually more ambitious and penetrating film It Follows, director David Robert Mitchell's Under the Silver Lake. House was von Trier's return to Cannes after being ousted for a previous provocation. The film begins as a characterization of the American male as that of a serial killer. It's an orgy of male violence against women, and the kind of film, even as critique, that perhaps the Me Too movement will change so that we get the other side and effect of this violence, and indeed 100 people are said to have walked out of the premiere. The film then descends into a parable of the artist as serial killer, with Matt Dillon von Trier as Dante visiting hell, accompanied by Bruno Ganz's Virgil, and at this point becomes simple, meaningless, and offensive provocation, citing Albert Speer as a tortured artist, a far cry from von Trier's better work, which had cast a penetrating gaze on the American psyche. House is the violent companion piece to the equally lifeless Nymphomaniac. Von Trier has managed to make two boring films about sex and violence. Matt Dillon as autistic murderer joins Michael Shannon, Michael Fassbender, and Joaquin Phoenix, the other three among the best actors of their generation, as exhibiting the terrifying empty expression of the violence and anger behind the male psyche in this later and more desperate stage of neoliberal capitalism. Under the Silver Lake begins very promisingly with hints of a mystery in this gentrified capital of Los Angeles, Hiptum, as an out-of-work slacker attempts to solve the disappearance of a girl who lives next door, a la Rear Window. He follows her friend in lush traveling shots via vertigo, only this time as farce in a paddle boat, acts like Jeffrey in Blue Velvet in his claim that there is a mystery he is trying to uncover, and watches as one of the numerous parties he attends, a whispered version of To Sir With Love that recalls the crying sequence in Mulholland Drive. The film's enlightened conceit, though, is that while Lynch and Hitchcock explore genuine social and psychic mysteries, late capitalism has destroyed the idea of mystery and replaced it with nothing but brands. The slacker Sam, in a conversation with his nominal girlfriend after having sex, during which they watch celebrity news, talks about the first image he masturbated to, and then asks his actress friend what was her first. Not her first lover or first person she had sex with, but the first thing she masturbated to. She answers it was a character, a logo on a tube of toothpaste, a double remove from human experience. Or Hitchcock had the Raymond Burr character in Rear Window as a murderer. Sam spies instead in the window of the missing girl, the landlord looking for the rent. The film does eventually dissolve into a haze of ramblings about pop culture as a so-called solutions to the mysteries become more and more trivial, actually unintentionally illustrating its thesis that what is meaningful in culture has been destroyed by profit mongers. Unfortunately, that also includes the latter half of this film. The real secret of Silver Lake, the gentrification that has moved Hispanic peoples out of the area and replaced them with hipsters, is elided in these pseudo-solutions. Problems also beset to Italian films, both about the contemporary problems plaguing that country. Dogman has an astounding performance by Marcello Fonte as a dog groomer in a forgotten, left for dead suburban wasteland somewhere in Italy. Fonte is the new Dino Risi, the Italian everyman actor of the 50s, only where Risi was a conformist who somehow managed to do the right thing. Fonte's character is a decent man who is drawn into a net of violence as his way out of the poverty facing the country's small business class. The opening sequence, where he is gingerly washing a vicious bulldog, is recapitulated in the film with his relationship with a local thug, Simone, who is Mussolini-like in his brute violence. The film, though, in the end, succumbs to that violence and can find no other way out. Happy as Lazaro exhibits director Alice Rohrwacher's gift for recalling the 50s golden age of Italian social comedy, especially in its opening balloting of a young girl by a villager, seen not from his perspective, but from the jaded view of the girl's older sister. The film is about the village enslaved and in debt, to a countessa who does not inform them that their medieval sharecropping relationship has been outlawed in modern Italy and who claims they are better off enslaved. The second half, which has a miraculous beginning tied to the lead character Lazaro or Lazarus, purports to be a fable about how these times continue in the present, but by the bumbling of the peasants in the modern world, instead simply illustrates that what the Countessa said about them needing their domination is true. A similar problem besets the Japanese film Shoplifting, which won the Palme d'Or as Best Film. A gang of loving misfits live by pilfering, but form what the film contends is a better family unit than the more traditional one, adopting a girl who is beaten in the supposedly more loving family structure. Ultimately, though, the film does not sustain its critique and ends up showing that the outsider family is as morally bankrupt as those it seems to oppose. Wonderful performances, including the wife of the lead character, who is alternately carefree, seductive, and maternal. Finally, there is the documentary Whitney, which opens with shots of the Newark riots and places its subject, Whitney Houston, in the middle of the riots where she grew up. The film details her rise through gospel music, her rough schooling and abandonment by her mother, Sissy Houston, who was on the road with Aretha Franklin, her father stealing from her, and her husband, Bobby Brown, beating her and leading her further down the path of drugs. It also details her remarkable vocal ability, energy, and the way her voice and the famous kiss at the end of The Bodyguard with Kevin Costner, a relationship with a white man in which the black woman has the upper hand, impacted the black community. Unfortunately, this type of tell-all film can easily degenerate into its own form of exploitation. The moment where a friend reveals that Whitney was molested and then pauses and reveals by whom, and we find out it's a celebrity molestation, feels simply designed to sell the film rather than to get to an inner truth about the singer. Her desperation was indeed there from the beginning in her first mega hit, I Want to Dance with Somebody, where the next line is, with somebody who loves me. She searched her whole life to find that somebody, did not find it, and the search in all the wrong places, and her pumping up by the celebrity machine combined to kill her. Here are my Cannes prizes, best film Cold War, best director Shared, Paolo Palinowski, Cold War, and Godard for Image Book, Best Actor, Marcello Font, Dogman, Best Actress, Ando Sakuro, Shoplifting, and Best Supporting Actress, Melanie Rover at War, and the supporting cast of union workers of that film. Back in 2 weeks with my Cannes wrap-up, a look at the films in the other categories, including Bonnie and Clyde and Camus in Kazakhstan in The Gentle Indifference of the World, a new horror monster in Scandinavia in Border by the author of Let the Right One In, and a longer look at The Resplendent Woman at War about an Earth Mother battling global energy companies. This is Bro on the World Film Beat, signing off from Cannes 2018. Oh, change of mind,
sound of breaking glass. Dennis Bro is the author of Film Noir, American Workers and Postwar Hollywood, Class Crime and International Film Noir, and Maverick or How the West Was Lost. His current book, to be published in 2018, is Hyper-Industrialism and Television Seriality, The End of Leisure and the Birth of the Binge. C'était Breaking Glass de Dennis Bro sur Art District. Très bonne suite de nos programmes, jazzistiques et artistiques, à notre écoute.